Basel, that is you. Your mother is hanging on to you as you're being dragged, your father. What do you want the world to know about Mustafa Yatta, about your community in this film?
I want the world to really act seriously. The international community should take measures and act seriously to end this, like demolitions and ethnic cleansing that it's happening everywhere in Gaza, in the West Bank, through different policies and different like reasons that the Israelis try to separate out, which is all lies. It's all about land, that they want to steal more and more of our land. That's very clear on the ground, because every Palestinian community being erased, there is a settlement growing in the same place. This is happening right there in the South Hebron Hills, in everywhere around the West Bank in Area C, and now they are entering camps since January until now by demolishing, like destroying the camps in Jenin, Tul Karim, into Bas, and forcing people to leave their homes to get away. And the world is just keep watching and not taking serious actions. And the opposite, actually, the Israelis kept receiving all like this amount of violations of the international law, the human rights laws. It's very clear that it's violated every day by the Israelis, but nobody almost cares. The opposite, they kept receiving weapons and money and relationships diplomatic covers.
We have to leave it there. I thank you so much. Look forward to interviewing you and Yuval in the United States. Basel Adra, co-director of the Oscar-nominated documentary No Other Land.
This is Logan,
Colin,
and Jeremiah,
and we are Amnesia, and you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland. From its founding, KBOO's purpose has been to serve as a community-driven alternative to mainstream media. In a new year, with numerous executive orders from a new presidential administration and the rise of misinformation, KBOO affirms its duty to serve its community. KBOO, its programmers, volunteers, and staff do this by bringing you accurate information, by giving space to underrepresented voices, and by uplifting arts and culture. In these uncertain times, KBOO seeks to be a guiding light for those who are scared, those who are affected, and those who are fighting the good fight. KBOO stands with the immigrant community, the LGBTQIA+ community, the disability community, and all of those affected by the new administration. We stand here at 90.7 FM in Portland, 104.3 FM in the Corvallis-Philomath area, 91.9 FM in Hood River, and at kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland's Sunderland RV Safe Park will be open until June after an earlier threatened closure. Anti-Trump protests sprung up in cities across the country on President's Day. And Oregon lawmakers consider a bill to ban octopus farming. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 18th, 2025. I'm Althea Billings. Portland's Sunderland RV Safe Park will be open through June, 3 months longer than originally expected. The RV park is located near the airport, and it's a place where 60 houseless Portlanders who live in their RVs can safely park and live from their vehicles. It's a lot owned by the Portland Bureau of Transportation. In December, it was announced unexpectedly that Sunderland would close to RVs in March so that PBOT could bring its leaf mulching vehicles back from a different lot. This caused an uproar from folks, including former Multnomah County Commissioner Sharon Myron, who emailed city and county leadership urging them to extend the life of the RV park. Now, residents can stay through June, which is well into Portland's warmer weather months. The deadline to close the RV park has been pushed out, and the Sunderland RV Park residents may have the opportunity to move their RVs to another site when Sunderland RV Park closes in June. Protests are building across the country in response to early actions taken by the Trump administration. Hundreds of people turned out in Portland, Vancouver, and Salem on Monday to protest Trump, Elon Musk, and the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE. These protests happened across the country, too. Minnesota's capital city was among the sites of President's Day marches, where demonstrators voiced their concerns about legal and ethical boundaries being crossed in the pursuit of slashing government spending. Mike Mullen has more.
In many U.S. cities, President's Day this year was used to sound the alarm over actions by the Trump administration. Minnesota protesters braved sub-zero temperatures Monday to express worry about the loss of democratic norms. The 5051 movement is described as a grassroots effort where organizers connect online to schedule peaceful protests in all states. Monday's demonstrations marked the second nationwide group of rallies held in unison since President Donald Trump returned to office. Woodbury's Rob Gallagher attended the one in St. Paul, saying democracy is being undermined as Trump's staff aggressively cuts agency budgets and staffing in the face of court challenges.
It affects everybody, the great many, and for what? You know, it's incompetently done. It's done without checks and balances on appropriations that have already been made and without checks and conflicts of interest. And so it's wrong in every dimension.
Those conflicts of interest he referred to involve claims that Trump advisor Elon Musk, who's leading the purge of spending reductions, is violating ethics because his companies hold government contracts. Other protesters say Congress isn't doing enough to intervene, including Democrats. Musk and other Trump officials defend their actions, saying these are changes Americans voted for. The 5051 movement says it's not tied to any political party, calls for Trump to be impeached and for Musk to be investigated. Gallagher hopes the feelings they're expressing dovetail into other forms of peaceful protest in both blue and red states.
Consumers purchasing drives the economy, and if we could, you know, leverage this sort of group activity into no buy day, or, you know, no purchases over a weekend, or to other kinds of group activity that would move the needle.
Gallagher, who is retired, says he worked many years in business and was trained to reduce wasteful spending. He says any entity could benefit from an efficiency makeover, but adds what's happening in Washington, D.C. right now isn't the way to do it. Attendance has varied at these protests depending on the state and weather. Most in the Midwest has seen several hundred people show up, with state capitals serving as the backdrop. This is Mike Mullen for Minnesota News Connection.
Oregon lawmakers are considering a bill to ban octopus farming in the state. No farms like this exist, but HB 2557 would prevent them from operating. For some of the folks who testified in favor of the bill, it's because of how smart octopuses are. They shouldn't be eaten or commercially farmed. For others, like Representative Zach Hudson, who helped sponsor the bill, it's more about environmental sustainability. He says farmed octopus isn't a sustainable food source because of how much fish and crab the animals eat. Advocates say it's a preventative issue. But it's gotten criticism from the Oregon Farm Bureau, who says it sets a, quote, concerning precedent to ban a type of farming without a scientific justification. It's also been criticized for potentially provoking cultural bias against eating octopus at all, which is an important part of different cuisines from around the world, including Asian, Mediterranean, and Pacific Islander foods. Sudden cardiac arrest is the number one cause of death on school campuses, and a new bill in Salem would require schools to have a safety plan. Isabel Charlet has more.
New legislation backed by the American Heart Association would require all Oregon schools to have cardiac emergency response plans in place. Research shows that 1 in 300 youth has an undetected heart condition that puts them at risk. Mary Taft's daughter, Nina, owes her life to CPR and the use of an automated external defibrillator, or AED. Taft, a Bend resident, was watching 13-year-old Nina play soccer when the young athlete suddenly collapsed unconscious. Since Nina had no history of heart problems, Taft didn't know what was going on.
My husband just launched into action. He immediately started doing CPR, which he had not done since he was a lifeguard in high school, so over 30 years ago.
Taft says it was thanks to her husband's quick thinking and the soccer coach who knew there was an AED nearby that saved Nina's life. House Bill 2529 would provide funding for Oregon schools to conduct regular cardiac emergency drills and have AEDs accessible within 3 minutes from any location. Nina has since had open heart surgery, says Taft, and made a full recovery after the sudden cardiac arrest. Since the incident, Taft has started a heart-safe program in her community. She urges people to support the new legislation.
Sudden cardiac arrest is the number one killer of young athletes in our country. So anything we can do to make our community safer, our schools safer, we should be doing that.
According to the American Heart Association, about 90% of people who suffer heart attacks outside the hospital die. CPR, especially when performed immediately, can triple a victim's rate of survival. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Portland cannabis businesses are suing to block Oregon Measure 119, passed by voters in November. It allows workers at cannabis stores to unionize, since it was unclear whether they had the right to do so before the measure. The lawsuit argues that Measure 119 violates employers' free speech rights and is illegal under federal labor law. The Oregon measure requires cannabis store owners to enter what's called a labor peace agreement, basically meaning they'll stay neutral when union organizers talk to their workers. But since marijuana is still illegal at a federal level, there's been some ambiguity. The companies suing to block the measure say they can't follow Oregon law and comply with federal law at the same time, and they're asking a judge to block the measure. Measure 119 was the first cannabis ballot measure voters had seen in a few years, but it probably won't be the last. The Oregon Cannabis Cafe Coalition has submitted an initiative petition to allow the creation of cannabis cafes in Oregon. Businesses where people can consume cannabis do exist in other states like California, Alaska, and Colorado. Initiative Petition 39 would allow for those types of businesses here in Oregon. The main obstacle would be Oregon's Indoor Clean Air Act, passed in 2016, which doesn't allow smoking indoors. But the person behind the effort told Willamette Week that it's possible to get around that issue if the cafes have good safety standards, including extensive ventilation systems and air quality monitoring. The group is gathering signatures to sponsor the measure first, and will need more signatures in order to qualify for the November 2026 ballot. Washington has a shortage of nursing home caregivers, and advocates say part of the problem is inadequate benefits. In the face of this growing need, new legislation in Olympia would provide affordable health care in hopes of keeping more people in the industry. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
Workers' rights advocates and nursing home providers say Washington has a long-term care workforce crisis and that inadequate benefits in the nursing home industry are part of the problem. Legislation moving through Olympia, known as the Essential Worker Healthcare Program, would provide affordable health insurance to nursing home workers. Alicia Harris is a certified nursing assistant, or CNA, at a skilled nursing facility. She says a family of four needs to pay $1,200 a month for insurance with a high deductible and only 30% copay.
It's money that we could be putting toward, you know, groceries, we could be putting towards rent, saving. It's tough.
Nursing home employers who join the new program would receive a payment from the state for health care, which would be matched by Medicaid. Employees could participate for about $50 a month. Supporters of the legislation say poor nursing home benefits fuel an extremely high CNA turnover rate. Harris says when there isn't enough staff, the residents don't get the care they deserve.
I love my residents. I love doing what I do. And I would hate to leave them just because of health insurance. But at the same time, it is a financial burden on me and my family.
Over the next 10 years, the number of people who need long-term care in Washington, especially nursing home care, is expected to grow rapidly. At the current rate, there won't be enough skilled caregivers to meet the need. Two essential workers healthcare program bills are currently in committee in Olympia. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
Republicans in Congress are considering big cuts to programs like Medicaid in the next federal budget. A coalition of more than 50 organizations called Fight for Our Health has just launched in California to urge Republicans in Congress to protect Medi-Cal, the health insurance program for low-income Americans. Suzanne Potter has the details.
Town hall meetings start tonight across California, pushing back against congressional Republicans' proposal to cut hundreds of billions of dollars from health care programs for low-income families. Organizers from the Fight for Our Health Coalition are sponsoring town halls targeting U.S. Representatives David Valadao in the Central Valley, Young Kim in Orange County, and Ken Calvert in the Inland Empire. Rachel Lynn Gish with Health Access California says all three lawmakers have turned down an invitation to face constituents at the town hall meetings.
It's very hard for people to make ends meet right now. Do these Congress members really want to be the ones to vote to raise health care costs on families in their district on top of everything else? Because that's exactly what will happen.
Republicans on the House Budget Committee have been tasked with finding $2 trillion in cuts to federal spending in order to extend the 2017 Trump tax cuts, which critics say have primarily benefited wealthy people and big business. It's estimated some $880 billion in cuts would likely come from Medicaid, known as Medi-Cal in California. Gish says that would lead to a loss in coverage for millions, plus layoffs, longer wait times, and possible closures of community clinics and hospitals that rely on Medicaid funding. Gish warns if the cuts go through, California would be forced to slash its budget as well, with cuts and layoffs across the board.
One-fifth of our state budget is federal funding through Medi-Cal. Medi-Cal alone is 60% federally funded. There is no way that California would be able to make up any loss of the magnitude like they're talking about in Congress in our state budget.
The Fight for Our Health Coalition includes 50 groups that advocate for a wide range of issues for just about every demographic group in the state. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. At 6, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be rainy with an overnight low of 45 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy too with a high of 52. Today in history, in 1930, Elm Farm Ollie becomes the first cow to fly a fixed-wing aircraft, and she also becomes the first cow to be milked in an aircraft. The milk was then put into containers attached to parachutes and tossed out of the aircraft over the onlookers in the city below. These antics were a part of the International Aircraft Exhibition in St. Louis. The quote of the day is from American novelist Toni Morrison, born this day in 1931. She said, quote, "At some point in life, the world's beauty becomes enough. You don't need to photograph, paint, or even remember it. It is enough. No record of it needs to be kept, and you don't need someone to share it with or tell it to. When that happens, that letting go, you let go because you can." On a Middle East visit, Senator Richard Blumenthal rejects a Gaza takeover. And another aviation accident draws attention to recent FAA cuts. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I'll be very blunt. My view is that the Trump plan is a non-plan. It's a hot mess. The possibility of takeover by the United States is a non-starter.
Democratic Connecticut Senator Richard Blumenthal joins those flatly dismissing President Donald Trump's idea of the U.S. taking over Gaza. The right-wing Israeli government says it's going ahead with Trump's plan to move the Palestinians out, but Blumenthal says he sees more hope in plans taking shape among the neighboring Arab states. Saudi Arabia is hosting meetings this week where Trump's Gaza displacement and redevelopment plan will be a main topic. Secretary of State Marco Rubio will take part and also join planned negotiations with Russia on the Ukraine war. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was not invited and says they won't accept any deal reached without them. A Delta flight from Minnesota to Toronto crash-landed yesterday, the latest in a series of aviation accidents. Biden administration Secretary of Transportation Pete Buttigieg says that calls into question the layoff of nearly 300 FAA employees during a time of understaffing. Meanwhile, the Department of Energy is scrambling to rehire just fired employees tasked with maintaining nuclear weapons. A bill moving in the House would loosen a CFPB rule capping overdraft fees at $5, raising that to $35. The agency estimated the original rule would save $5 billion for the consumers. And Rebecca Garrard with Citizen Action of New York says the fees land hardest on families that can least afford it.
It's devastating, and it contributes to debt that people are unable to remove themselves from and exacerbate a crisis of poverty and affordability that's already problematic.
Finally, Democratic freshman Arizona Senator Ruben Gallego is challenging his party to rethink engagement and voter turnout, specifically with the working class Latino men that voted in higher numbers for Trump last fall.
We're afraid of saying like, hey, let's help you get a job so you become rich. Like we use terms like bring more economic stability to you, right? And like these guys don't want that. They don't want economic stability. They want to like really live the American dream.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Indigenous activist Leonard Peltier is headed home at long last after his life sentence was commuted by former President Biden. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. After nearly 50 years in prison, Leonard Peltier is free to go home. He was released Tuesday morning from a federal prison in Florida. Former President Joe Biden commuted the sentence of the Indigenous activist last month for his role in a 1975 deadly shootout with FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. Peltier, an enrolled citizen of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians, will reside on his tribal homelands in North Dakota, serving out the remainder of his sentence in home confinement. The Indigenous organization Indian Collective is bringing him back home. In a statement, Peltier said, "Today, I am finally free. They may have imprisoned me, but they never took my spirit." He also thanked his supporters, saying he looks forward to seeing his friends, family, and community. Indian Collective CEO Nick Tilson in a statement said, "Peltier never gave up fighting for his freedom, so they never gave up fighting for him." Many see Peltier as a symbol of racism and oppression against Native Americans by the justice system. While the move to free Peltier has drawn applause from members of Congress and groups like Amnesty International, it has been opposed by law enforcement officials. On Wednesday, Indian Collective is hosting an event to celebrate his return home and a community feed in Belcourt, North Dakota. The event will be live streamed. Peltier is 80 years old and is said to be in poor health. The chairman of the Fort Peck, Assiniboine, and Sioux tribes delivered the State of Tribal Nations address to the Montana legislature on Monday. Justin Greyhawk says tribes in the state are healthy, strong, and resilient. He began the speech by highlighting some successes he says lawmakers and the state have supported in Indian country, including a water settlement, economic ventures, and a tax-sharing agreement. Greyhawk says bills tribes have supported are funding for law enforcement, addressing missing and murdered Indigenous people, and expanding Medicaid. He says among issues tribes will continue to advocate for are Indian education, protecting tribal hunting and fishing rights, and bringing back bison to tribal lands. Greyhawk ended his speech by encouraging partnerships with tribes.
This is an important time to come together. It is important to remind ourselves and our surrounding communities that together we are greater than the sum of our parts.
There are 7 reservations and 12 tribes in Montana. Nevada's only sitting Native American legislator has introduced a bill to recognize Indigenous Peoples Day on what she calls the correct day, the second Monday in October. The bill was heard last week, as Alex Gonzalez reports.
Governor Joe Lombardo issued a proclamation designating August 9th as Indigenous Peoples Day in Nevada. But Assemblywoman Shea Backus says it doesn't pay Indigenous communities the recognition or respect they deserve. She says Assembly Bill 144 would align both dates as is celebrated across the nation.
Indigenous Peoples Day isn't just about a day of recognition. It's about placing Indigenous voices at the forefront of decisions that shape the future of the state. It is this deep cultural connection that has shaped the character of the state of Nevada and should be celebrated.
Backus says opponents of the bill see it as an attempt to remove Columbus Day, a federal holiday, from the books. She rejects that notion and says the second Monday in October could instead be shared between both holidays. Republican Assemblyman Richard DeLong questioned the precedent the change of date could be setting for the state.
Under state law, there are no overlaps. This would be the first time that the state ever decides to have a period of observance that you have two of them coinciding on the same day. So in that sense, this is unique and different.
But backers of the bill say banks and other establishments already recognize the October date both as Indigenous Peoples Day and Columbus Day and see the bill as a formality to codify the joint recognition into law. I'm Alex Gonzalez reporting.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Trump officials told NATO last week that U.S. policy on Russia, NATO, and the war in Ukraine had fundamentally changed. As one observer notes, the new policy represents a retreat from previous security obligations and an acceptance of Russia's war aims. In short, appeasement. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Munich has again become the symbol of appeasement, less than a century after the West sold out Czechoslovakia to Hitler. This time around, it was the Trump administration that has sold out Ukraine, turning that country from victim of aggression to supplicant seeking defense from Russia while the U.S. stands aside. Before Trump's top officials descended on Europe this past week, Donald Trump seemed to have three ideas for ending the Ukraine war: abandon ship, meaning depriving Ukraine of U.S. aid and thereby forcing it to agree to a settlement with Russia; deploy European troops in Ukraine to deter Russia after a peace agreement; and give Ukraine aid in return for guaranteed access to its rare earth mineral deposits. Michael Waltz, Trump's national security advisor, confirmed all these points and reiterated what he said was the Trump administration's underlying principle, that the Europeans, quote, have to own this conflict going forward. After Munich, we can fill out the key elements of U.S. policy on Europe and the war. First, Russia is no longer a U.S. adversary. Now it is a partner in the search for an end to the war in Ukraine. Second, the U.S. can no longer be counted on either to defend Ukraine or be a reliable member of NATO. Third, Ukraine will not only have to concede territory to gain peace, it will also have to make concessions to the U.S. if it is to continue receiving U.S. aid. And fourth, Ukraine must not join NATO. It must find another way to ensure its future security. Let's examine these points more deeply. Statements by Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, and Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth make clear that European security will have to operate on new rules. First among them is that Russia has legitimate security interests that go beyond its border with Ukraine and comprise Europe as a whole. Relations between Russia and the U.S. are now effectively normalized. Far from having to pay a price for its aggression, Russia and the U.S. are now at the table in Saudi Arabia, bargaining over Ukraine's future, and perhaps much more, without either Ukraine's or Europe's participation. When Trump was asked the other day if Russia would give up anything in a settlement of the war, he said, quote, "It's too early to say what's going to happen. Maybe Russia will give up a lot. Maybe they won't." In other words, Russia won't give up anything. In fact, Trump is moving right back to where he was with Vladimir Putin during his first term. The Reagan rule, trust but verify, is not Trump's. He continues to be understanding of Putin's invasion of Ukraine, which in Trump's mind only occurred because Russia feared that Ukraine would become a member of NATO. No expert on Russia would agree with that. When asked if he trusts Putin, Trump said, quote, "I trust him on this subject of peace, and I think he would tell me if he didn't." That is what appeasement looks like: ignoring facts on the ground, presuming the best of intentions for an aggressive adversary, and selling out one's friends in a desperate effort to get rid of a foreign policy problem. While Russia will be able to solidify its hold on eastern Ukraine and Crimea, Ukraine will have to depend on the NATO countries to come up with some sort of security guarantee. We can expect that discussions in NATO with the U.S. absent will involve hard bargaining that will result in far fewer troops being deployed to Ukraine than President Zelensky of Ukraine wants. Not 150,000, but maybe 30,000. Whatever the number of troops Ukraine gets from the NATO countries, the U.S. has also insisted that they not be identified as a NATO deployment. That cuts to the weakening U.S. commitment to NATO and its supreme principle of collective security, all for one and one for all. If those troops are simply each country's contribution, any combat with Russian forces will not occasion an automatic NATO response that would compel the U.S. to participate. Thus has Trump limited U.S. involvement in European security and bowed to Putin's strategic view. Ukraine is left dangling in another important way. It's rebuilding. Russia would now seem to be off the hook. It will pay nothing for the hundreds of billions of dollars in damage to Ukraine, for the children it has kidnapped, for the hospitals and schools and energy facilities it has destroyed. Which countries will step up to support the rebuilding? The Europeans will argue that they are already having to be responsible for Ukraine's defense. Trump is only interested in what Ukraine can do to repay the $500 billion he says they owe us. We need to recoup those costs, says Michael Waltz, meaning not just rare earth materials, but natural resources like oil and gas. In other words, Ukraine will be treated like a U.S. colony. Ukraine has rejected Trump's demand, but it is hard to see how long it can hold out. In all, I think it is fair to say that Trump et al. Are embarked on a plan to redraw the map of Europe in favor of white Christian nationalist regimes, abandoning democratic friends and long-standing obligations. In the past, turning our back on predatory autocrats in Europe has resulted in war. We never seem to learn. I'm Mel Gertow for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, February 18th, 2025. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertov, the producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Isabel Charlet, Suzanne Potter, Mike Mullen, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members, lovely folks like you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can do that. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.